Open the podcast doors, Hal.
It's Kubrick's Universe, the Stanley Kubrick Podcast.
Suggest what you can do with that promotion.
Colonel Dax, you will apologize at once or I shall be placed under arrest.
I apologize for not being entirely honest with you. I apologize for not revealing my true feelings. I apologize, sir, for not telling you sooner that you're a degenerate, sadistic old man. And you can go to hell before I apologize to you now or ever again.
Since the publication of the book 25 years ago, no one dared to make this movie. It was too shocking, too frank.
What sort of casualties do you anticipate, sir?
Say 5% killed by our own barrage. It's a very generous allowance. 10% more getting through no man's land, and 20% more getting through the wire. That leaves 65%, with the worst part of the job over. Let's say another 25% in actually taking the anthill. We're still left with a force more than adequate to hold it.
General, you're saying that more than half my men will be killed.
Aside from the inescapable fact that a good many of your men never left the trenches, there's the question of the troops' morale. Don't forget that.
The troops' morale?
Certainly. These executions will be a perfect tonic for the entire division. There are few things more fundamentally encouraging and stimulating than seeing someone else die.
Where in heaven's name are they?
On the left.
Where are the rest? Hero plus one and they're still in the trenches. They're not advancing.
Miserable cowards.
They're not advancing. The barrage is getting away from them. They're still in the trenches.
Yes, sir.
Captain Nichols.
Yes, sir.
Order the 75s to commence firing on our own positions.
Happy New Year and welcome once again to Kubrick's Universe. We've had a busy year, so took a short break, but we always endeavor to provide at least 12 episodes a year. So don't worry, we're back. And we're going to provide you with another lovin' spoonful of your favorite director. On behalf of Stephen Rigg and myself, Jason Furlong, we welcome you back to the Kubrick's Universe podcast. All right, now we have the fourth part in our Tikatria Kubrick series. As usual, hosted by Mark Lentz and moderated by James Robert Sherman, with contributions by the many wonderful, wise, willful, and sometimes weird members of the SCAS Academy. For any listeners new to SCAS, SCAS is the Stanley Kubrick Appreciation Society. This episode, we are joined by Scott Edwards, Brian Kahn, Jonathan Harvey, Nick LaMattina, David Sukavati, Robert Castle, Kathy Metzger, John Harrig, A.J. Shapiro, James Phillip, Sam, and Stan Dorfman. And this time, we're going to listen in as they examine Kubrick's fourth feature film, Paths of Glory, which was released in 1957. This is Tikatria Kubrick. The 1957 anti-war film, Paths of Glory, was directed by Stanley Kubrick and co-produced through Kirk Douglas's film production company, Bryna Productions, and a joint venture between Stanley Kubrick and James B. Harris's Harris Kubrick Pictures. The screenplay, based on Humphrey Cobb's 1936 novel, was crafted by Calder Willingham, Jim Thompson, and Kubrick himself. Set during World War I, the movie features Kirk Douglas as Colonel Dax, the commanding officer of French soldiers who defy orders to carry out a suicidal attack. Dax then defends them against cowardice charges in a court-martial. The cast includes Ralph Meeker, Adolphe Menjou, George MacReady, Wayne Morris, Richard Anderson, Joe Turkel, and Timothy Carey. And in what is irrefutably one of the most powerful final scenes in cinema history, the film also introduces the only female character, portrayed by German actress Christiane Harlan, who later married Kubrick. The couple met on set. Despite Kubrick's previous film, The Killing, not succeeding at the box office, MGM hired Kubrick and Harris based on their potential. Remembering Cobb's book from his youth, Kubrick proposed it as their next project. Kirk Douglas secured a $1 million budget advance from United Artists after being impressed by the script. Production, costing slightly less than $1 million, occurred entirely in Bavaria, Germany. Timothy Carey was fired during production, and around 600 German police officers played the soldiers. Upon release, the film faced severe criticism and censorship in France, Germany, Spain, and Switzerland due to its anti-military tone. Despite not receiving Academy Award nominations in 1958, it garnered international awards and positive reviews, boosting Kubrick's reputation. The film received a BAFTA nomination for Best Film, won the Jussi Awards Diploma of Merit in Finland, and earned recognition at the Writers Guild of America Awards. In 1992, the U.S. Library of Congress deemed it culturally significant, preserving it in the United States National Film Registry. We now present to you this conversation, which was recorded on September 30th, 2023.
Okay, Scott, go ahead.
Since I went through the film and in its entirety in the document, I'll focus on the end of the film, because that's something that has such great power and something that means a lot to me in watching the movie. It encapsulates movie making in one scene. If you read a summary, if you looked at a script, it wouldn't have any kind of value to you. It wouldn't hit you in any respect. And so what you're reacting to is pure movie making. It's the probably one of the best examples of the montage. We talk about Eisenstein and the effect of having these different shots and how they juxtapose against one another in order to create the scene. And it develops in this way where you're seeing the soldiers playing up what Dax is experiencing in his mind, that is there anybody of value? Is there anything that really means anything in a positive respect? Everybody lets him down. The whole system doesn't work. I've been through this whole thing. I'm at war. Nobody could win a war. It makes no sense whatsoever. He hears the hooting and hollering, and he shows up at that door, and all this does is cement that thought. She gets up, starts to sing after being belittled, to be really described as less than human. She's something that's been acquired, was one of the words used. Yeah. She starts to sing. They can't hear her sing. Then her voice emerges. And what I would like people to comment upon is, why do they change their character as she begins to sing? It could be that it's because of what's in the song itself that they're experiencing. They've left home, and the song is about soldier. Soldier doesn't return until it's too late, and his love is tremendously ill. Are they responding to that? Are they responding to their own shame, where they had taken this person and dehumanized her to an extent, then become shameful about it, and that's where the tears are coming from? And the way that it's intercut back from the singer to the soldiers watching, you see those little bits are just long enough where you could feel those people as real people and the way they're responding in a real way. And as was pointed out, then that one guy that hits it, you do that zoom in on him and that tear comes down. Then you're part of that group. You're crying with them. And maybe you don't know why you are, Tori. What are you reacting to? So I wanted to focus on that end because it's also something that would be emblematic of the opposite you would think about Kubrick, which is this, oh, he's cold and he doesn't really, he's misogynist and all this stuff that, you know, none of this is true, really. So what does that seem to me, to you? What do you think they're reacting to?
Great, Scott. Thank you. Hi, James.
Very good, Scott.
James, it's your turn.
Okay. Interesting that you mentioned that the ending. I had written down in my notes, one of the things I actually said in my notes about the ending, and I totally agree with you, Scott. Great observation on that. What it was for me, I think, was it was a quantum leap. We've been talking about quantum leaps, right? From Fear and Desire all the way up to this film, right? And again, I see this as another quantum leap for Stanley Kubrick. His emotional maturity and understanding, okay, is far superior to the first three films that he did. I mean, just into a realm where we start to see his genius as a filmmaker, his ability to use the film language visually, right, to really make a huge emotional impact on the viewer, right? And especially that ending. The same thing could be said for that whole horrific sequence of the execution, you know, from the start, okay? And one of the things I found interesting was an observation I had was that Frank Capra made a film. It was a documentary, Why We Fight, I think. And one of the things was there was this long sequence where he had drumming while showing images of fascism, of the fascism of the Japanese, of the Italians, and especially the Germans, right? And the thing is, it was like I really saw Stanley Kubrick sort of saying, yeah, these guys are no better. This was a visual message that he's saying these guys were no better. I love the beginning of the film where they're having the back and forth between Adolph Monjou and George MacReady, and they're talking about, you know, he's saying, it's like, well, if you can't do it, George, you know, if you can't do it, it's, oh, no, I didn't say I couldn't do it, right? That whole sequence was even better done, okay, and was a flashback to that, okay? I admitted it was James. Anyway, it was a flash forward, to that great scene at the end of A Clockwork Orange where the bureaucrat is talking to Alex, and that whole dance of bullshit that they do, you know, is just, which is one of my favorite scenes in all of movies, right? But I never made that connection. It was like Stanley Kubrick had done that earlier, you know, and so that whole sequence, okay, was definitely very reminiscent of what he'd later do in A Clockwork Orange. I had mentioned previously, I was talking about how I find the connections between Malick's film Within Red Line and this one visually for certain, because it's like the shot of the anthill is very similar to the, if you guys have seen The Thin Red Line, that crucial sequence of trying to storm the machine gun nest at the top of a ridge in A Thin Red Line. And the thing, it was like the visually, it's almost, you know, it's almost very similar to that, those initial shots of the anthill, right? One of the things I noticed, again, I'm just making observations that I noticed from watching last night. I loved the no man's land when they go in at night, you know, the patrol, they have it at night. Looked like the moonscape from 2001, A Space Odyssey. It just, that was the first thing I kind of, and I've, you know, noticed that. But overall, I just would, to the overall, since I got about a minute left, I just wanted to say, I think that this film, even though I love The Killing, and I think The Killing is a work of art, okay, this is even more so. And so the thing is, it's like, I love this progress upward, okay, of Stanley Kubrick's abilities as a filmmaker. He really has captured, you know, the language of cinema. But at this time, I really think he has become, if not soon to be, but is already a master of the film language. And that's just, you know, one of the things I was saying was that definitely the visuals of the cinematography are right up Greg Toland, Orson Welles. So it's like, you know, just but that's German expressionism, and nobody else did it better than Wells except for Stanley Kubrick. So that was just my observations.
Thank you. That's great, James.
Yeah, who was next, Mark?
I am next. Okay, I'm going to read from my notes. I'm glad we're watching them in order and we're experiencing the development of his career. and practice in the space of 13 weeks rather than 45 years, as was needed for his contemporaries to do so. Even if you see them all at a film festival, they'll usually be out of order. I'm a lifelong Kubrick fan, and this is literally the first time I'm doing it this way. Movement. Every scene starts with movement, either the camera, the characters, or both. The movement serves two purposes. Thematically, we see the mechanical clockwork of the machine that everyone is trapped inside. Psychologically, I read recently that humans have something called mirror neurons that fire in imitation of a movement we see someone else making. That's how we learn to do stuff. But as viewers, maybe movement energizes us, and another reason for him to use so much of it. This film maybe has more movement and blocking choreography than any other film. Makes me want to pay attention to how movement is used in his subsequent films. I noticed the hero shot of Kirk Douglas during the trial, which is he's always shot somewhat from below, unlike anybody else. It feels rhetorical, is telling us how to think, which is not necessarily bad. It's a technique. The lighting is, again, super theatrical in a prisoner's cell, for example. Every new viewing, you have all your memories from all the other times you've seen it. It's like a dream that after a while, you realize you've had it before, even if you've never thought of it consciously since. This time I remembered that I was hoping right up to the very end on my first viewing that the men wouldn't get shot, and how horrible it was when they were, and how drawn out that whole sequence is. And yet all these viewings later, it still remains as compelling as the first time. And that's true of kind of throughout Kubrick. I don't know. I'd like to know, understand why it just continues to be compelling. The way the artillery commander comes in to talk to Dax the evening before the execution, we're set up to think, here's the happy ending coming. But I realized this time that there's actually no way Brillard can agree to pause the execution. To do so would admit that the fault lay with him as well as Moreau. The tracking shot before the trench, through the trench before the shot, with the men getting more and more coated with dust from the barrage, as it is a brilliant visual metaphor for these men are being sent to their deaths. Kubrick thought up a way to express it non-verbally that is justly famous. As he said, the important thing is the feel, not the think of it. With all the motion, we are allowed to contemplate the mechanism that they're all trapped inside. And lastly, since my time's running up, there is an excellent interview with James B. Harris on the Criterion disc that we need to watch together. He said Kubrick made all decisions based on logic, with sound reason, not with emotion. All the bad decisions made in The Killing and Paths of Glory are not based on logic. Kubrick had a fear, this is from Harris, that if he didn't think of everything, the one thing he didn't think of would ruin everything. That comes from being a chess player. And that's the end of my time for now. So go ahead, James.
Okay, I'm gonna call on Brian.
So I am constantly amazed at this movie. I think it's his best linear narrative film that he's ever made. And I think it still resonates 60 years later. That doesn't mean he didn't creatively go on to do other things. This is a 10. It is a perfect, perfect film in terms of a metaphor for one of his universal themes about, you know, you talk about, I mean, Scott talked about the power of the last scene, how war is this dance. You know, I found it interesting, the dancing sequence is one dancing ball scene, and every scene with the general is really a dance. And they're dancing on a chessboard. That main set, it looks like a chessboard. And it's the humanity that is stripped away from everybody. I mean, Scott was talking about it before. Basically, over the course of the, you know, hour and 25 minutes, the humanity is just stripped out of these people. And the only thing that reinjects the hope of humanity is the singing of the German girl singing a German song to French officers that they resonate, which crosses across the whole war thing theme here, which I think gets lost because they're French soldiers and she's German. And that is the dehumanization of what war does to people. And you only see it in that last sequence, and that's why it resonates so powerful. You know, technical stuff is incredible. The tracking shots, the long takes that incorporate the dancing moves. Like I said, the dancing of the generals, every scene with the generals in those three shots is a dance. They're almost dancing around each other. And it's almost contrasted with the dance that takes place one evening when is it Dax or Dax comes to talk to him. And everything is a quid pro quo, which talks about the inherent choice that humans and man make in the fork in the road between choices of good and choices of evil, except the institutions of war take those choices away. And you have obviously Kirk Douglas who tries to triumph above it, but even he recognizes by the end of the film kind of the dehumanization of the institution of war. So that's mainly, you know, what I have to say about it. I mean, it's the first film that really has more of a straight linear narrative. I mean, up to now, he's had weird narrative structures that he's played with, and he will continue to in future films. I think this is my favorite Kubrick film. It's 60, 70 years later, and it is just as powerful today as it would have been in 1957 with the commentary about what war does to the institutions and to the breakdown of humanity. And that's kind of a universal theme. So I'm trying to think if I had anything else here that was of any sense. No, it's just that universal theme that he goes back to in many of his films going forward about, you know, choice and not the most positive outlook about men and males in terms of the choices that they will make. But it kind of takes a female to kind of restore humanity into the piece. And maybe that's not the hopeful sign of the future. That's it.
Thanks, Brent. Okay, Jonathan, why don't you go next?
One of the main things I'm noticing is a much stronger thematic continuity between Stanley Kubrick's many different films on these reviewings and a certain parallel. So when I saw the people doing the ballroom dancing just the evening before the court martial, I thought of the ballroom dancing of The Ghost and The Shining. The redemptive presence of the German singer at the end is reminiscent of the way that Alice acts as a redemptive figure in Eyes Wide Shut. And the long tracking shots going down the trench remind me of the tracking shots following Danny on his tricycle in The Shining. And so I'm just seeing these threads of continuity that I didn't see before. One thing that puzzled me is that you actually hear a lot more about how influential a film The Killing was than you hear about the influence of this film. This is arguably a better film than The Killing. The Killing is perhaps, in a few ways, more innovative. I found it interesting that Winston Churchill thought very highly of this film, and that made me wonder, well, I wonder what Dwight Eisenhower would have thought about it, because those are the two World War II leaders that gave warnings about the bad ways in which military think in some ways. I also, Adolf Manjou is very politically conservative. So I was just, well, so also the fellow, so is Arlie Ermey, who played the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket. They're both very politically conservative men. And so I'm sort of curious as to what they thought of this film. Arlie Ermey has had nothing but good things to say about Stanley Kubrick and Full Metal Jacket. I don't know that Adolf Manjou has said much. Adolf Manjou said that the two people who required the most takes of any director they worked with were Stanley Kubrick and Charlie Chaplin. But then I don't think Adolf Manjou ever worked with Orson Welles. Chaplin did a silent drama film that he did not appear in as an actor that was a straight drama called Woman of Paris, and I think Manjou was in that. And I was just, without being able to articulate, I was just very impressed with the editing, the way the film was edited with the switches between shots was obviously very well thought out. And it's unfortunate this film got banned in a lot of places when it came out. The French government wouldn't show it. And in fact, not only was it banned in some places, but one or two countries insisted that the opening music, which was the French national anthem, be replaced with something else. So that's about it.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks. Okay, next on our hit parade. Nicholas, are you available? Are you there?
Hi, everyone. All right, so this is the second time in my life that I have seen this film. I just finished watching it about half hour ago. I can say that I could echo a lot of what has already been said. I'd like to focus on the questions because I think they a good springboard to kind of start. The first thing that was asked was about the ending. And so I think we all get that it's about finding humanity, seeing beauty in an otherwise very dark world. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But what I realized was that Kubrick, being that we have discussed him as having sort of a detached, nihilistic worldview, might, in a sense, be using a motif of a song to illustrate a larger point. In Paths of Glory, it ends in a song. And in Full Metal Jacket, it also ends in song. And so I thought about that. Thought about that really rather quickly in the end. It's the first thing that came to mind. I said, you know, why would he be doing something like this? And I think it's a quick way to summarize theme that he's trying to explore throughout, whether it's 2 hours or 96 minutes as Paths of Glory. So I've seen it in other films. He could be one of the first directors because, you know, war movies started, of course, in the silent era, and then you see a lot, and of course, in the 30s, the 40s, going forward. But I've never quite seen a war film, prior to that, and please someone correct me if I'm wrong, ending in song. Also, that the whole film is a perfect screenplay. I read the screenplay prior to watching the film. It's a 145-page screenplay, if anybody wants to pull it up. Which is interesting because film time usually dictates that it's a minute per page. But in this sense, it was the exact opposite. It was really heavy in dialogue. And it actually played out more like a stage play rather than a film, even though it's a visual medium. And he shot it for film. But there's so much dialogue and you have to really listen. And so the general conflict here is about a duality of how men view war. Do they view people and their fellow comrades as pawns on a chessboard, as someone said? Or do they view them as human beings with feelings and emotions? And I think that's what he's trying to discover. And the Kirk Douglas character is trying to bring reason to an unreasonable scenario. You see this then echoed many years later in films like Platoon, where you have the Barnes character, who has lost all of his humanity. And so you also see it in Casualties of War when Sean Penn loses his humanity. And it's always juxtaposed that someone that's trying to maintain honor and maintain their sense of duty and commitment, not only to humanity, but to the war and the war effort. And that's in the Michael J. Fox character. So when we look at the just from a purely visual standpoint, you see a lot of 1917, even though that, you know, it's modern. It's a modern film with no edits per se. You can't really see the editing. You see the tracking shots. You see the staging. It's all there. And the last thing I'll say is that the Kirk Douglas character, when they were doing the executions, you could see Kubrick's affinity and knowledge of still photography when he captured his reactions to the men being shot. It was just it was almost like a still photo, but moving. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed this film.
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks. Thanks, Nick. Okay. Next on the hit parade. Let's see, David, would you like to go?
Okay. What Scott was saying at the ending about the ending, I saw it as a soldier's remembering it as a time before the war. That's how I, and that's why they were so
cheerful. And I saw Paths of Glory in film school or film class. And the first thing I noticed was the personal human element in the soldiers and the part that they played in the battle. Years later, after many viewings, I'm still impressed with the battle sequence and the script by Stanley, Jim Thompson, and Calder Willingham. Along with solid performances, they gave the story a real impact. It took 60 workers for 3 weeks in day and night shifts to create the battlefield, using 8 cranes to dig crater holes and trenches to create a barren battlefield. It was littered with authentic World War I shells and war equipment. And then, there, of course, the barbed wire. One reviewer called it a suicidal attack. Special effects man Aaron Lang, who was also a chemist, worked on European war films for 27 years at that point. The story is partly based on the war tragedy that involved Corporal Theophile Maupas, I believe that's how you pronounce it. 4 corporals were executed to set an example on March 17th, 1915, for refusing to leave the trenches. It became known as the Maupas Affair and made famous through efforts of Corporal Maupas' wife, Blanche. Her book, The Executed, and 20-year struggle to clear her husband's name, her request for absolution was accepted after legal battles, help from other groups, and 2 dismissals by the Supreme Court. According to official figures, 442 soldiers were tried and executed in 1915 alone. Stanley had read a book, Paths of Glory, by Humphrey Caldwell. When he was 14, he suggested the story to Jim Harris, and Jim secured the rights for $10,000. After Kirk Douglas agreed, Stanley could cast the other parts with best actors, and Harris said Stanley was a genius at that. It appears Stanley and Harris worked closely throughout Paths of Glory, called Kubrick's first masterwork. After seeing Kubrick's work in the correct ratio, it's apparent that this is true. If you have become aware of Stanley's interest in chess, there appears to be chess-like moves, and the story tells very well of military manipulation. And I'm again impressed with Kirk's performance and the legal expertise during the trial. Joe Turkel's scene about the fear of death versus the fear of pain is lifted directly from the novel. The story was kept alive from information transmitted from family to family. Carrie's character slumps to one knee, as described in the book. The book ends with Roger firing a bullet into each man's head. This is a quote from Stanley. Films deal with emotions and reflect the fragmentation of experience. It is thus misleading to try and sum up the meaning of a film verbally. Also on the desk, when Kirk Douglas says to General Brolin, "You can go to hell," there's a figure of Napoleon.
All right. Thanks so much. Excellent, David. Thank you. Okay, Robert Castle, next.
I now I've seen this movie a lot of times. I used to show it in my high school class when I wanted to illustrate what World War I was like and the fighting. It seemed to me that this was the movie to show about trench warfare. And apparently, when it was mentioned earlier, I don't know if Jonathan or somebody mentioned, Winston Churchill thought it was a very accurate depiction of the warfare. And not too bad. I don't think he was totally on board, but he mentioned the depiction of the senior officers. Now, he had Gallipoli hanging over him, so that sort of put him in that group of bad planning, sort of like General Haig or Field Marshal Haig of the British side. When I showed the film to my students, I sort of did a sort of half historical and half what the film was doing. And I had them look for motifs or things in there And one, it struck me early on in watching the first watching the film, was the references to lower organisms. In fact, the term lower organism is used by Richard Anderson when they're in the hut. They talk about the men scattering on shelling, and he says that's sort of like a lower organism kind of thing. And Kirk responds, that seems like a human thing.
Tell me, Colonel, how did your relief come off last night?
We drew some artillery. 29 casualties, sir.
Yes, notice it on the road in. Utterly excusable. Stupid. All swarmed together like a bunch of flies, just waiting for someone to swat them.
Well, they never learn, it seems. They get in a tight spot under heavy fire. Gang up every time. Herd instinct, I suppose. Kind of a lower animal sort of thing.
A kind of a human sort of thing, it seems to me. Or don't you make a distinction between the two, Major?
Oh, well, yes. Very regrettable, of course. Very, yes, indeed. Major, would you be kind enough to excuse us for a few minutes?
Yes, sir. Of course.
In going through the film, there is, it seems to be, constant reference to quote-unquote lower organisms. And to me, the best depiction of it is when they go across no man's land. I mean, I saw it less as a moonscape and more as sort of the primal muck in which the life is sort of crawling through, you know, the early forms of human life, crawling through the dirt, the dark, and you know, sort of the primeval slime. I also had them look for things like the elements of blackmail and persuasion. Because, you know, it happens a lot. We have in the persuasion category and sort of, I'm going to call it blackmail, but the first scene where Moreau gives in to McCready gives in to General Moreau's, or I can't think of the name. He gives in to the fact he might get a promotion.
Paul, I've come to see you about something big. It's top secret. It must go no further than your chief of staff and not to him, unless you can trust his discretion.
Of course.
A group of armies is forming on this front for an offensive very soon. Headquarters is determined to make a complete breakthrough. Why are you smiling?
I'm really sorry. I thought for just a moment I knew what you were going to say. Please go on.
I never knew you were a mind reader. What did you think I was about to say?
Something about the anthill.
You are a mind reader.
Well, it is a key position. It's in my sector. To be perfectly honest, I've heard some talk. You know, there's nothing really secret around headquarters.
Well, what do you think?
Well, it's the key to the whole German position in this sector. They've held onto it for a year now, and it looks as though they'll hold onto it for another year if they want to.
Paul, I have formal orders to take the anthill no later than the 10th, that's the day after tomorrow.
That comes pretty close to being ridiculous, don't you think?
I don't imagine I'd be here if I really thought that. Paul, if there's one man in this army who can do this for me, it's you.
It's out of the question, George. Absolutely out of the question. My division was cut to pieces. What's left of it is in no position to even hold the anthill, let alone take it. I'm sorry, but that's the truth.
Well, Paul, there was something else I wanted to tell you. However, I'm sure that you'll misunderstand my motives in mentioning it.
What was it?
Oh, you'll be bound to misunderstand. However, as your friend, maybe I should tell you.
What are you trying to say, George?
Paul, talk around headquarters is that you are being considered for the 12th Corps.
The 12th Corps?
Yes, and without another star. Now I've pushed it all I can. 12th Corps needs a fighting general, and you're overdue in that star. We both know that your record is good enough for you to refuse this assignment on the grounds you've stated. No one would question your opinion. It's simply get someone else to do the job. So, you shouldn't let this influence your opinion, Paul.
Oh, I'm sorry. Have a cognac?
No, thanks, Paul. Not before dinner.
George, I'm responsible for the lives of 8,000 men. What is my ambition against that? What is my reputation in comparison to that? My men come first of all, George. And those men know it, too.
Because I know that they do.
You see, George, those men know that I would never let them down.
That goes without saying.
The life of one of those soldiers means more to me than all the stars and decorations and honors in France.
So, you think this attack is absolutely beyond the ability of your men at this time?
I didn't say that, George. Nothing is beyond those men once their fighting spirit is aroused.
Well, Paul, I don't want to push you into it if you think it's ill-advised.
Don't worry, George. You couldn't do that if you tried.
We have Moreau using blackmail on General Dax or Colonel Dax when he's trying to convince him to attack the anthill. In fact, that scene sort of mirrors the earlier scene where there's great resistance and finally the officer gives in, maybe for different reasons, but still it's an interesting comparison.
Well, Colonel, what do you think of it?
What do I think of what, sir?
The anthill. Colonel, your regiment is going to take the anthill tomorrow.
You know the condition of my men,
sir. Oh, naturally, men are going to have to be killed. Possibly a lot of them. They absorb bullets and shrapnel. And by doing so, make it possible for others to get through.
What support will we have?
I have none to give you.
What sort of casualties do you anticipate, sir?
Say 5% killed by our own barrage. That's a very generous allowance. 10% more in getting through no man's land, and 20% more getting through the wire. That leaves 65%, with the worst part of the job over. Let's say another 25% in actually taking the anthill. We're still left with a force more than adequate to hold it.
General, you're saying that more than half my men will be killed.
Yes, it's a terrible price to pay, Colonel. But we will have the anthill.
But will we, sir?
I'm depending on you, Colonel. All France is depending on you. Am I amusing you, Colonel?
Not a bull, General. I don't need a flag waving in front of me to get me to charge.
I don't think I like your comparison of the flag of France to a bullfighter's cape.
I meant nothing disrespectful to the flag of France, sir.
Patriotism may be old-fashioned, but show me a patriot and I'll show you an honest man.
Well, not everyone has always thought so. Samuel Johnson had something else to say about patriot.
And what was that, may I ask?
Well, nothing really.
What do you mean, nothing really?
Well, sir, nothing really important.
Colonel, when I ask a question, it's always important. Now, who was this man?
Samuel Johnson, sir.
All right, now, what did he have to say about patriotism?
He said it was the last refuge of a scoundrel, sir. I'm sorry, I meant nothing personal.
You're tired, Dax. You're very tired. It's you who are exhausted, not your men. And it's my fault. I've given you one impossible task after another. You need rest. You need it badly. And you never would either. Therefore, you're not going to have any say-so about it, Colonel. As from right now, I'm ordering you on indefinite furlough.
General, you can't take me away from my men. You can't do that to me, sir.
Not to you, Dax. For you. For your good and for the good of your men.
The good of my men, sir.
If a commanding officer lacks confidence, what can we expect of his men? Naturally, I don't want to relieve you, but I must have your enthusiastic support. Not once have you said that your men can take the anthill.
We'll take the anthill. If any soldiers in the world can take it, we'll take the anthill.
And when you do, your men will be relieved. Get a long rest.
You also have the, after the patrol in no man's land, Paris goes back and forth with Roger, and Roger essentially is basically not using blackmail so much as persuasion. Like, nobody is going to believe what you say. And therefore, you know, you just keep quiet.
Well. Surprised, Lieutenant?
Yes, I am. Happily surprised. I thought you'd been killed.
You didn't wait around to find out, did you, Lieutenant?
Now, look here. What do you mean?
I mean, you ran like a rabbit after you killed Lejeune.
Killed Lejeune? What are you talking about? I don't think I like your tone. You're speaking to an officer. Remember that.
Oh, well, I must be mistaken then, sir. An officer wouldn't do that. A man wouldn't do it. Only a thing would. A sneaky, booze-guzzling, yellow-bellied rat with a bottle for a brain and a streak of spit.
That's
where
enough,
a spine
Corporal.
Ought to be. You got yourself into a mess, Lieutenant.
Oh, I have I? Well, you've got yourself in a worse one. First, general insubordination. Second, threatening your superior officer. Third, refusing to obey an order and inciting others to do the same. Now, how do you think those charges are going to look on paper?
Not half as bad as these. Endangering the lives of your men through recklessness, drunk on duty, wanton murder of one of your own men, and cowardice in the face of the enemy.
Philip, have you ever tried to bring charges against an officer? It's my word against yours, you know. And whose word do you think they're going to believe? Or, let me put it another way, whose word do you think they're going to accept? Now, I'll tell you what I'm willing to do. So far, all I have written in this report is that you and Lejeune were killed while out on patrol. I'll fix this to read that you made your way back after becoming separated during the skirmish. That'll end the matter once and for all.
You killed Lejeune, you know that, don't you?
I'm sorry, it was an accident. I'd give anything in the world if it hadn't happened, and that's the truth. Honestly, I know you don't like me, but what kind of a man do you think I am? Oh, good morning, Colonel.
At ease, man. I've been waiting for your report, Lieutenant.
Well, I think we found out a thing or two.
Everything go well?
No, sir. Private Lejeune was killed.
How'd it happen?
And then later, Dax blackmails Briard in trying to convince them to, you know, save the men.
It's been a pleasure discussing this with you, Colonel, but I'm afraid that I better be getting back to my guests.
Forgive me for having kept you from your party. Oh, by the way, sir, if you heard that General Moreau ordered his own battery commander, Captain Rousseau, to open fire on his own positions during the attack? Well, of course, the captain refused without a written order. But General Moreau demanded that he commence firing on our own trenches. Again, Rousseau refused without an order in writing, but again he was ordered, and again he refused. All in front of witnesses.
Do you actually believe this fantastic story?
Here are copies of the sworn statements from all the principals involved. Battery Commander Rousseau, Captain Nichols, the artillery spotter, the telephone clerk, and my own deposition.
What has all this got to do with the charge against the condemned prisoners?
The general, in a tantrum over the failure of an impossible attack, orders his artillery to fire on his own men. Now, the same officer, on the same day, orders a court-martial in which three of his men are sentenced to be shot. General, what would your newspapers and your politicians do with that?
Colonel Dax, are you trying to blackmail me?
Sir, that's an ugly word, but you are in a difficult position. Too much has happened. Someone's got to be hurt. The only question is who. General Moreau's assault on the anthill failed. His order to fire on his own troops was refused. But his attempt to murder three innocent men to protect his own reputation will be prevented by the general staff.
And one thing I always did, I always stopped the movie right before that, right after that scene. And then the next time I'd show the movie the next day, before I'd show it, I'd ask the students, what do you think is going to happen? And almost universally, they thought, well, you know, he's going to save them. He's going to save the men. So they're a bit shocked by that. But overall, since I saw this so many times, I didn't really see like new things. So I had to look for, I read a few things to see, well, what, you know, what new thing or what thing did I think of? And the one thing I saw pointed out, I think it was in Mario Falsetto's book on a narrative and stylistic analysis of Kubrick's films. He talks about there's no optical point of view from the generals. That is, we don't see anything from the general's point of view. Whereas we do see things from Dax's point of view and the soldier's point of view. And it sort of is the great contrast in the movie. It sort of echoes the contrast between the chateau and the trenches. And that's about it.
Very good, Robert. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, next, Kathy, would you like to express your views?
Yes, I was just struck again by how amazing the camera work is in the trenches, in any of the trench scenes, and how much that communicates the exhaustion and the physical and emotional exhaustion and a kind of despair. I think you get that kind of from the beginning among the enlisted men, that they're in this horribly ugly, dangerous place. They have no power over their own destiny. And I think you get that kind of despair. In the final scene, I thought on the first time I saw the movie that they transitioned too quickly. You know, as soon as her voice gets louder, they're almost instantly in tears. But this time it struck me that being as battered as they were in every sense of the word, they would make emotions are always there at the surface. So an emotional transition that fast becomes more believable. I also was really impressed by Kirk Douglas. I mean, I've been a Kirk Douglas fan, but he's not always that subtle in all his movies. You know, he has been known to chew the scenery occasionally. I thought the transition, especially the transition on his face, when he's outside of the inn and he's hearing them cheer, he has this kind of, how would you say, kind of, oh, that's what humans are worth sort of expression on his face. But then when he hears, I guess, see, at some point, I think he opens the door and sees them in tears, the expression is very different. It's more, you know, I'm not sure how to describe it. His expression has definitely changed to maybe being more hopeful for humanity. And then, of course, he's told they're going to into combat again right away. So much for that. But yeah, I'd say those were my main impressions.
Very good, Kathy. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, next, John.
So I was thinking, you know, as the topic says, thinking about when you're young and when you're older seeing the film. And when I first saw it, you know, I had to rent it on VHS. And I think the emotional scenes resonated more with me when, you know, you're watching on a small screen with like the Christiana at the end singing and just, you know, Colonel Dax's speech when he's like, and you can all go to hell, you know, it's like that. Those two scenes I remember especially hit me. And I remember I was watching it as a teenager and a religious member of the family came in like right when the chaplain was getting struck in the frame. They're like, what is this crap? Turn it off. No, when they just, that's one of my memories of seeing it the first time. And it's like, I turned it off and continued watching it later out of respect for their religious views. But yeah, this time, you know, I've seen it so many times, like other people said, I wanted to go back to like things I had read about the film. And I actually turned to like, you know, reading all the controversy, because we just watched The Killing, right? And you know, there was controversy over that, you know, Kubrick taking credit for basically the screenplay. Because, you know, apparently, you know, Jim Thompson, he was really pretty upset with Kubrick. He was going to go sue him at the Writers Guild for taking credit on The Killing. You know, I was looking at that. And then, you know, I was looking at what Kirk Douglas said about it. And, you know, what was going on in Kirk Douglas's life. So, like, if you look at, like, 19, you know, the 53, 54, you know, that's when you have, like, the McCarthy stuff going on. And you got Walt Disney, who's testifying against his union strikers as all communists. And I was reading a bit in Kirk's biography about how, you know, if you were a Jew or Russian, you're basically a communist. And he was a Russian Jew, of course. So he was feeling like a lot of stress at that time. And then, so I'm looking at the timeline. So in 55, I think that's where he was originally accused of like raping Natalie Wood or something, or that's when the accusation came in. And then, also in this time, like right before he starts on this, Walt Disney invites him over because he's doing like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And because Walt Disney had his own like little personal train, and they filmed his kids, and he was going to sue Walt Disney, and his wife was like, are you crazy? Everybody likes Walt Disney. Don't do it. So, you know, it was kind of like a down point in the career. And then he sees this movie, The Killing. He's like, oh my God, who did this movie? It was Stanley Kubrick. Okay, I got to meet this guy. This had written and directed by Stanley Kubrick, right? So then Kubrick comes in and he's like, oh, Stanley, did you write this? And he's like, yes, I wrote it along with, you know, these two other guys. and it's just kind of interesting that, okay, so then he's getting nominated for an Oscar at the same time, this other film, and he also has another film the same year. So he was basically doing double duty, doing Past Glory and this other Viking film at the same year, at the same time. And, you know, it's just interesting to hear his perspective on, what was going on. But he doesn't talk a whole lot about Paso Gloria, the shooting of it, in this biography that I was reading. But I thought that was interesting.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John. AJ.
Hi. Okay. So first of all, everyone's topics were really interesting and really thought out. And I didn't have as much time to prepare a couple of things, but I was trying to go back to when I first saw the film, when I was like maybe a freshman or sophomore in college. I'm way more familiar with Lolita and the Killing because I'd seen that way more times. So I will definitely come back for Lolita and have all my notes and the paper that I wrote in college and everything since. So for Paths to Glory, I just figured to focus maybe on a few thoughts, like the influence of seeing how All Quiet on the Western Front, done from 1929, like influenced parts of making Paths to Glory, and then what you can see in war films since. Especially there's a international film called Joyeux Noël, which has Daniel Brühl in it. And it just really all excellently shows that First World War trench warfare and what it means to be on opposite sides and no man's land. And, you know, when you also think of just the influences of like other stories, like I remember comparing it to Orwell's A Hanging or his other short story, Shooting an Elephant. And, you know, just the dehumanization of, you know, the enemy, and also the, like, I think there was another topic brought up before, but the classification between the lowest of the soldiers to the highest of the ranking officers, the generals, so that you know that all of these decisions are made from the top down. And Dax's ability to stand up for his soldiers, his team, and the right thing, and having that morality. But then I was also thinking about the endings of Paths to Glory, and how, and I read this a little bit, on how the studios generally don't like it when a film has a unhappy ending, or like, you know, the heroes, you know, die, or the heroes don't get to have that justice. So in Paths to Glory, there was like, you know, a way to shoot it so that they had the original ending matching closer to the book, and then they had a different ending that the studios were pushing for that they think audiences would more so appreciate. And it was Kubrick and Harris that said, you know, at the very end, like, no, we're going to go with the original ending and it's going to go well. And the distributors at the end were like, okay, we agree. And, you know, took it as is. And that last ending of like, of the officers getting executed stuck, because without that push by that team, you know, it would have been a very different kind of ending. And this idea kind of carries through the endings of Kubrick's other pictures. You know, at the end of The Killing, it's this incredible surprise of the money just like lost to the wind in a sense, and just the unfortunate circumstance of going through all of that and all of the planning, and then it just, you know, ends up the way it does. And then if you've seen Jim Harris's own directorial debut, The Bedford Incident with Sidney Poitier, you would see at the end too, spoiler alert, that everyone dies, because also the idea of war is that there are no winners. There are, you know, there are no survivors in a sense. There's always damage, always destruction, always terrible consequences. So at the very end of that film, you can see just the complete, you know, destruction of both sides. And Harris, again, had to fight for his ending to get that into the final cut. And he did win in that case, you know, against the studios. So Harris has a very good history of fighting the studios for the right ending for the story, instead of just allowing the higher ups to get what they want. So I thought that was also a very interesting part of the story to Paths of Glory, where they're fighting for an ending of how it should be rather than what those, you know, higher ups that they have to answer to would prefer, and fighting their case. So they didn't win in the movie, but they won with the final cut.
Cool. Very good. Thanks, AJ. Thanks for your views.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, Sam, go ahead and express your views. There you go.
Quite by coincidence, last night I was reading a biography of somebody who was involved in this war and was around until relatively recently. That was Charles de Gaulle. Yeah, I mean, he was a very, you know, cold-blooded creature in a way that is not healthy. I mean, there were all kinds of atrocities, massacres carried out while he was president, and, you know, he brushed them all off. 200 people showed up floating in the River Seine, their bodies, you know, couldn't care less. And, yeah, that was the kind of attitude of general soldiers of that time. And I suspect it's not very different even now, but they are much better at, as it were, covering up the way they actually have to operate. But that's why that Churchill quote, that this was the closest it came to how it actually was in their mentality, yeah, that really rings true. And by the way, I was also reminded of something somebody mentioned about how the movie was banned. Jean-Luc Godard interviews Fritz Lang at the end of, in the notes for Contempt. And he talks about how, I think at that time in France, it was literally illegal to criticize generals of the French army. So he was saying, like, why is this? So anyways, yeah, a fascinating interview between two, you know, truly great giants. But yeah, a lot of these things were still going on. You can go read, you know, 60s magazines and see how the military is portrayed. I mean, basically, we are living in a world in which a lot of those values have changed, or at least seem to have changed. The events of the last 18 months, you know, perhaps make one doubt that. But nonetheless, yeah, it's been a while since I've actually seen the movie. So, yeah, I can't talk about the details. But, yeah, so I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Sam. And then last but not least, Stanley.
Hello, hey. Everyone.
Hi, Stanley.
First, let me express my gratitude to everyone in this group, because I feel like you make me smarter every time I attend. Thank you very much for what you do, who you are, and what you share. Okay. Yeah. Now, my comments are a little bit all over the place. The priest says to the prisoners, he says,
"You have plenty of time yet, certainly more than enough to prepare yourselves."
Well, I ask the question, how much time does one need or does one desire to prepare themselves to die? And I submit that that might have been a question of Stanley's. There are several notable quotes here that I scrambled to jot down. See if you can recognize who said them and in what circumstances. A soldier's best friend is a rifle is a soldier's best friend. You be good to it, it'll be good to you. Now, that was said in this film. What other film was that said in? Come on now, you know. There's no such thing as being shell-shocked. How about that one? If a soldier wants to be a ninny, let him put on a dress and hide under the bed. Could that line be used today in a film without a lot of pushback? Dax says at one point in response to what the general said, yeah, it's kind of a human thing. You know what I mean? When he was referring to being more humanistic. How about the reference to the Samuel Johnson quote? Patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. Hello, current events. If these little sweethearts refuse to face German bullets, they'll face the French. Gentlemen, there are times when I've been ashamed of being an American, excuse me, a member of the human race. And this is one of them. Who said that?
In the movie or now?
In the movie.
Dax.
Dax said that to the generals.
Yeah.
James brought up the credits, and I also took note of the credits. And what I wrote down was that the credits were large, were black, but there was bold black fonts on a black background. What that meant to me at the time, and there were the French national anthem was being played underneath. Well, the black on the white, or the white on the black provided a stark contrast, which equaled for me the contrast in the personalities in this film. The generals, Dax, throw in the people who got executed if you want to. But, you know, we've been talking about humanity. By the way, I came in a little late. I came in at the very end of Mark Lentz's. Scott, I apologize. I'm sorry that I missed yours, but there were several great references to it. A couple other things while I still have time. The music in this, and I know David is always attuned to the music. There were the French anthem. There were drum beats underneath throughout. Sorry about the phone. There were contrasting volumes and speeds of the drum beats. How about when Corporal Farrell, who was played by Nicky from The Killing, how about when he slams the cockroach and you hear the slam on the table? The password, of course, there was a password in this film, much like there was a one-word password in Eyes Wide Shut. In Eyes Wide Shut, we know the password was Fidelio, and here it was Calais. Loved your comments about the ballroom dancing on the chess floor. I never saw it. Thank you. That was worth this whole session for me. Another memorable scene for me was when George reveals at lunch and he says to Dax, "I never intended or I thought you stooped so low." How about when the general at the beginning of the film, the general is going through the trenches and he's saying, "Soldiers, are you ready to kill more Germans?" And he come across I think it was the last man who was dazed and confused and he didn't answer. Where else have we seen, in what other Kubrick film have we seen such a dazed and confused look like that in a soldier? Hello, Full Metal Jacket, just before he goes crazy. France cannot afford to have fools guiding her military destiny. And then that was from the general. And then he offers Dax the general's job. And he, of course, Dax refuses and basically says, "Take your job and shove it." Okay. Oh, one more thing. There was a great Columbo moment in this film, making reference to Columbo, Peter Falk. When France cannot afford, that's when Dax turns as he's walking out the door, I think, and says, "France cannot afford to have fools guiding her military destiny." I think that was, it was kind of like, "One more thing, General." Mm. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Scott, do you have a follow-up? And then we'll go to Jonathan.
I have a tidbit and a follow-up. Forgot to put in a note that I made that Adolf Manju served in World War I. And then the follow-up is there have been a few discussions about the scenes of persuasion and the first scene with the general and Dax. It happened about three or four times in this film. It reminded me of the scene in The Killing when Marie Windsor and Vince Edwards, they know that they're lying to one another, yet they're doing it. And you just go along with the ruse. And that happened in every one of those scenes. It was similar to that scene where they were saying, "Oh, I love you. And you know, we're going to stay together." And they knew that that wasn't going to be the case. They knew they were really going to take advantage of one another. And that was the same kind of conversation in this film.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Jonathan, you are next.
I had four follow-up remarks to things other people had said. One is, there's often a metaphor with chess in Kubrick's films. This literally strikes me as a chess game where one side is actually cheating and breaking the rules and hoping the other side doesn't see. I'm reminded of this saying that sometimes I've heard biologists say the reason they do not debate creationists is that debating a creationist is like playing chess with a pigeon who poops on the board, knocks over the pieces, flies away, and declares victory. And this is seen to me what the executioners were doing in this particular film. So it's literally chess with cheating. The second thing, AJ, I think, was mentioning about leads getting killed. The strong rule in Hollywood up until 1960 was that if an actor got top billing, their character could not get killed. As long as they weren't top billed, of course, Kirk Douglas gets top billing in this movie, then it was okay to kill them. And the first movie to break this rule, very flagrantly, was Psycho, a few years after this one. It is the reason why the original screenplay On the Waterfront had Brando's character getting killed, and they said they couldn't do it because it was top billing. And shortly after the film came out, the author of the screenplay published a novelization of On the Waterfront, which was faithful to his screenplay, and Brando's character, Terry Molloy, does get killed in the novelization, though not in the film. And the absurd case is that when they made a film of Anna Karenina, she didn't die either. That's the most absurd. The other thing is, the other war film I can think of with people singing at the end, which is actually very similar to this, is Kenneth Branagh's film of Henry V. I think closes with a scene where these rather beleaguered, disheartened soldiers who are beleaguered and disheartened by the fact that they won victory all sing a Te Deum together. I think it's not in Shakespeare. It's certainly not in Olivier's film of Henry V, but he just has all these victorious but still discouraged soldiers singing a Te Deum. It's very similar to the ending of this film, I think. And then finally, someone mentioned the rape accusation against Kirk Douglas, but I don't think that became public until long after Kirk Douglas's death. It was not public knowledge during Kirk Douglas's lifetime.
Thanks, Jonathan. Yeah, that was actually now after Natalie's death. Her sister made that accusation.
Yes, yeah. Lana Wood.
Michael Douglas said they were both dead at that point. Let the dead be dead. Something like that. Okay, or Bob.
Yeah, a couple things. It was going to the depiction of the trench warfare and such, and the Churchill quote. There was a sort of comical version of trench warfare in Blackadder Goes Forth, which was 1989. And it really captured, especially this sort of insanity of the generals. And in fact, the actual show got a lot of awards, but it was criticized in part for the way they treated the British staff. I think they portray Haig in it, and it's pretty, pretty strong. And it's definitely worth watching. I found I think it's the fourth Blackadder in that series. If anybody, probably can find it somewhere. And what was the other? In thinking about leads that died, I think John Wayne and Sands of Iwo Jima would be one who was killed. And he certainly was the lead star in it. And Janet Leigh's killing in Psycho, she actually wasn't the top billing. She was more or less like a final large credit in the opening sequence. So, though it was a shocking event. And and the one line that always gets me, it's when Ferrall is being questioned by Richard Anderson, and he's ready to tell like what he saw when he and Meyer were at the wire. And he's interrupted by Richard Anderson. Richard Anderson goes, "We're not interested in your visual experiences." And it struck me that that seems like if you're not interested in the visual experience, that would be the sort of anti-Kubrick line from a character who is not that sympathetic anyway. And also the idea that nothing from the past matters, only the present. That's another aspect of the court-martial and the point of view of the general or of the judges. And one final note, the man who headed the court-martial, an actor named Peter Capel, he was also the narrator at the beginning of the film. So you can take that for what it's worth.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Okay, we're up to Sam.
Yeah, for some reason, another movie which is not as well recalled for whatever reason, some of this reminds me of is Oh, What a Lovely War, which is not very well known, although it has an ensemble cast. And yeah, that I think also, by many accounts, is it's too close to the truth. It makes people uncomfortable, especially the senior command of the British Army, like people like Haig and French and others who, were sending people for, to the meat grinder completely knowingly. So, yeah, that might be something maybe we can discuss in some way. But a lot of movies only somewhat gingerly hint at, and this may be one of them, is, what was done with the women who were caught up in those regions where the fighting was going on, especially if they were young, and could be very young, teenage years. And there is some work that, they were considered fair game, and officers considered that as, what the soldiers were deserved. So, some of these things are, they require a bit of digging, but in a world where, human life has been devalued to an extent where, it's no different from life of an animal that is slaughtered and eaten, then, that can happen too. So one other thing that, as far as I recall, there were like more than 50,000 German soldiers who were executed during World War II for basically reasons like this, cowardice, insubordination, whatever. So, these were not uncommon things, especially in the more brutal armies, less democratic, shall we say. And in fact, soldiers were considered expendable. This is a very modern idea that, soldiers and their deaths need to be commemorated in Napoleonic wars. This was all taken for granted. So if anybody wants to look more into it, George Mosse, the historian who escaped Nazi Germany, has a great book. I think it's called Cult of the Fallen Soldier or something like that. So just to give an idea of how little value was placed on the life of soldiers.
Thank you, Sam. We got James, Stanley, and then AJ.
Just a real quick comment I wanted to make. Interesting. I saw this film with my dad for the first time when I was about 11 years old. And he made an interesting observation, and it's always stuck with me. And that when I was 11 years old was a long time ago. So we don't need to get into dates. But seriously, one of the things he mentioned was that when the battle, when the attack on the anthill started, and throughout that entire sequence, there was the sound that was supposed to be shells coming over, right? But it was like a continuous sort of sound that to my dad sounded like a wheat thresher. He grew up on a farm and spent a lot of time on the wheat thresher. And he was, he said it sounded like a wheat thresher slowed down. And so if you listen to that, there is the sound of the explosions, but at the same time, it's that sort of like a sound of something coming over, but it's so continuous. It's so constant. It sounds, like I said to my dad, it sounds like I've never heard a wheat thresher in action. Okay. But I found that to be quite an interesting observation, and it was just kind of a nice little detail. So that's just what I wanted to mention that I didn't mention earlier.
Let me squeeze in my sound bit. I watched this on headphones and was struck by the quality of the soundtrack as a whole, as a big step up for Kubrick, not just the effectiveness and variety of the use of music, but also things like the recording of the heels on the floor in the courtroom scene and the bird song after the drum roll for the firing squad.
Ready? Aim! Fire!
Stanley?
Yes, and on the morning of the execution, the first thing that you heard was a rooster crowing, signaling that it was the first thing in the morning. The sound was amazing. couple of quick points. I read that Gene Siskel of Siskel and Ebert referred to this film as a near-perfect film. Secondly, Stanley was 29 years old when he made this film. Now, I don't know about you, but at 29, I was still playing pinball machines. You know what I mean? So, and he made this film. Talking about banned films, it might have been AJ who brought this up. I recently saw, it's the Polanski film, An Officer and a Spy, which was also banned, yes? And this one, I believe, was banned in France until 1975. Jonathan, you're checking me on that, right?
That's correct.
Okay, Jonathan, I don't want to be wrong on that now. Okay. All right, that's it for now. Thank you.
You have one last thing, James?
I just want to say again, oh, I'm sorry, James P. I'm sorry. We got to get James.
Just a second. I'll write my last comment. I said surrealism, hidden path of glory, and pretty much in all his film are going to be, I think, a subject of research in the future. To return in Fear and Desire, if you remember, if you rotate the screen, you can see he had paintings. If you watch Path of Glory and pretty much all his film, I'm going to talk about it for 2001. If you rotate the screen, he hides paintings. It's not something like a conspiracy or I don't know why. He was very close to those people. Even if you watch in the past when he was working for Life magazine, he met George Groves. Someone was born the same day than him, July 26th. And George Groves was a surrealist painter, and he was creating paintings. When you rotate them, you see another things, new forms, new suggestions. Stanley used the same thing. I know it's difficult to imagine that, but he had paintings.
That's a good observation.
Yeah.
Very good, James. I liked it.
Okay.
You are in
later, for later. I'm going to talk about it.
Great.
Okay.
AJ.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this was a really great, you know, I want to say conversation to be a part of, and I really appreciate being invited into this, and I look forward to joining next time. And this is just more so for my curiosity about what kind of backgrounds all of you come from, whether you have like a film studies or filmmaking background, or I think Bob's, you know, said he was a teacher. So I'm just really curious, you know, how you all kind of came into not just loving Kubrick, but also other directors and other films, and you know,
just to mention. Curious.
AJ, how much time you got?
Now, AJ, I have a degree in film. I don't know if it's worth anything, but I do have one. So, I think everybody else definitely has a background in filmmaking, film scholarship. I know Nick, you have a filmmaking, and I'm not sure if you have a film degree, but I know you've been involved in filmmaking for a long time. So, but if anybody else wants to pipe in and give their
I have zero background. I'm purely an amateur.
I drive a wheat thresher.
A fan of film, but I'm a product of television production, a much more immediate discipline, but because film requires a lot of patience, my personality. So in the fork in the road, I went towards live and television more than film, but I do appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I have four relatives who've worked in the film industry. Three who have worked in the film industry, and one of whom wrote film reviews for a nationally circulating magazine for 2 years as a second moonlighting job. And the most extensive was my brother, who actually went to film school at NYU and worked as a video graphics designer for many, many years. I myself have written extensively on film for Wikipedia, about half of which has been for Kubrick movies, and two of which have a lot to do with it. I think my two major ones is all the different conspiracy theories about The Shining were gathered together into a single place for the first time in Wikipedia in 2010. I was the one who put all that information there. Then 2 years later, the film Room 237 came out. I was not allowed to make any commentary because Wikipedia has a strict rule on no original research and no synthesis. So I was not allowed to make any cross comparisons of that.
Then and I, any royalties for you, Jonathan? From
I'm afraid not. Okay. And I also wrote the Wikipedia section on the differences between the plot and the movie of The Shining. And about 10 years later, when Dr. Sleep came out, half a dozen of the reviews of Dr. Sleep said, for more information on the differences between the movie and the book, see this section of the Wikipedia article, and had a link to the section I read. So I'm guessing that in October of 2019, I was one of the most read article authors on Wikipedia.
Cool. I have my bachelor's and my master's in film studies, and I was a judge for a Long Island Film Festival for about 3 years. And then I found my career in more so on the law side of film. So I was working at a entertainment law firm, and then I joined SAG-AFTRA. So I'm, you know, it's been a long time since I've been able to really share in film studies classes and cinephile groups and such. So this is really great, and just happy to meet everyone.
Thanks. Well, welcome.
Great. Well, welcome.
Yeah. Nick, you have anything to add before I get to Stanley?
As far as my background?
Well, AJ knows your background, right?
Yeah. I'm pretty
we're fast new friends.
Yeah. Awesome. Actually, I was starting an advisory business, and AJ, I was on the message boards, and AJ, you know, welcomed me into the message board. Then we started talking. And so I said, you know, you got to really meet the guys. AJ, you're not right. This week, Robert Kohler, who is our resident film critic, who has literally been to some of the best film festivals in the world. And he's someone that you're really going to love. And Mark McKinnon's not here. He's a location guy. And there's just so many things you learn from one another. So, you know, we're really happy to have you, AJ.
Thank you.
But I would say, Nick and JJ, you're kind of the younger group coming up here. So you may be taking over the mantle here in due course.
These kids today.
Stanley, did you have?
AJ, in answer to your question, from time to time, I like to provide a little comic relief for all these film aficionados. And in the immortal words of Chauncey Gardner, as for me, I like to watch.
Oh, I love that movie, importance of being there.
Yeah. Anyway, Mark, I just like to add, Mark, thanks for putting this together. Again, once again, you're our resident expert in keeping everyone in line, and I appreciate it. And it was a great, great, great show. Great show today. Great show.
Thank
Spartacus,
you.
Spartacus yeah. Next.
Spartacus is next.
Have a good weekend, guys.
Everybody have a great one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks to our ever-devoted Mark Lentz and James Robert Sherman, and all at the SCAS Academy, Scott Edwards, Brian Kahn, Jonathan Harvey, Nick LaMattina, David Sukhavati, Robert Castle, Kathy Metzger, John Harrig, AJ Shapiro, James Phillip, Sam and Stan Dorfman. Next time we will be exploring Kubrick's fifth feature film, Spartacus, from 1960, as part of our ongoing Tikatria Kubrick season. By the way, Tikatria is Greek for 13. Okay, maybe you knew that already. But at any rate, please check out our two Facebook groups, the Stanley Kubrick Appreciation Society and Kubrick's Universe. Also, we've got two great YouTube channels, again, for the Stanley Kubrick Appreciation Society and Kubrick's Universe. And wow, holy one-point perspective, Batman. We are now in our seventh year. So please support us by rating and reviewing the show, and of course, head over to patreon.com, search Kubrick's Universe, and offer your support from as little as $1 or 1 English pound a month. Your support keeps the only continuously running All Kubrick podcast going. Anyone who rates, reviews, or becomes a Patreon supporter of the show will get a shout-out and also gets the chance to appear on an upcoming episode. On behalf of Stephen Rigg and myself, Jason Furlong, thanks so much for listening. We look forward to joining you once again in Kubrick's Universe.
C'est tout, les amis. Vous voir. It's Kubrick's universe. We just live in it.
We have taken very thorough precautions in this podcast against broadcasting anything which might only be attributed to human error.
These guys aren't scientists. They're making it up as they go along.
Thank you for listening to the Stanley Kubrick podcast. Come back soon.
It was real nice talking to you. Bye. Over and out.
This show comes to you from the Stanley Kubrick Appreciation Society.